Finally, shortly before the elevator doors closed on the two silent men, Jack said, "You want to grab a beer?" Adam reached out and held the doors open. "I've got to go by personnel, then I'm free. Meet in the lobby in 20? Ryan nodded. "Looking forward to it." The closest bar to the NewCorp complex was just over the border in Nevada on Interstate 15. Several low-end but enterprising casinos had sprung up within sight of California, hoping to catch the first Angelenos heading east to gamble in Nevada. It was another 30 miles or so to Vegas, but this desert oasis of hotels, strip malls, gambling halls, and fast food joints served as a way station for those without the time, gas, or inclination to drive all the way to the strip. Jack Ryan and Adam Yao sat at a table in the back of an utterly nondescript bar at Whiskey Pete's Hotel and Casino. Both men had beers in front of them, a Sam Adams for Ryan and a Shiner Bock for Yao. There was little talk those first few minutes beyond idle conversation about the casino and the drive. Each man was sizing the other up. They weren't unfriendly. These guys had a history together, and they liked and respected each other. But that was then, this was now, and they were each curious about what the other was up to. "You look different," Yao said.
"The beard?"
"Yeah. That, and you've put on some muscle."
"Got tired of being recognized."
"I guess so. Can't be too helpful in your occupation."
"What occupation?" Ryan asked.
"Never mind," Adam said over the rim of his glass before taking a sip. "I ran into a friend of yours."
"Really? Who's that?"
"Mary Pat Foley."
"Great lady.
Where did you see her?"
A pause.
"You know, just a work function."
"Right.
So, who was the girl?" Yao asked.
"Elise Legrand. She's with an outside vendor. Here at NewCorp for a couple of weeks. Down from Canada, she says."
"Nice."
"Yeah."
Another long pause. This conversation was going nowhere.
"Look," Yao said, "it's good to see you, but I guess neither of us has much to talk about."
Ryan replied, "The beer is okay."
Yao chuckled, surprised by the comment.
"It is, isn't it? I guess we could play craps or something, but you know I can't talk, and I doubt you will talk."
Jack Ryan shook his head now. He'd been thinking it over, and even though he didn't know what Yao was up to, he decided the guy could probably use a little intel.
"Not true. I need to tell you something. Hope you'll take the info as a favor and not ask a lot of questions."
"I've done good so far, haven't I?"
Jack said.
"The blonde?"
"Yeah, what about her?"
"She's a spook."
Yao made no outward reaction, but he lifted his beer and took a long drink. When he put it back down, he just said,
"You don't say."
"She's not here for you. I mean, I don't think so. She's supposed to be Canadian, but I think she might be French. Ex-DGSE would be my guess. Now she's working for a private company, NYC-based.
"How do you know this?"
"I'm with some guys looking into her outfit."
"Some guys?"
"Yep."
Adam shrugged. He let it go.
"You know what she's doing here?"
"Our guess is that she's here to steal intel for a company working with North Korea on a rare earth mineral mine they're developing."
Ryan stared at Yao's face, searching for a reaction. But Adam didn't blink. Adam Yao was a pro. Although he and Ryan had worked together in China, Ryan wasn't read in on Acrid Herald. Or at least Yao hadn't been told Ryan had been read in on it. Things were getting weirder by the day on this op, however, so the CIA officer couldn't be sure. But he wasn't about to start offering up intel, even to the son of the President of the United States. That
would be even weirder.
Interesting, Yao said. Unrelated to me, but interesting.
If you'd like, I could make a call and have her checked out by the authorities.
Ryan knew Yao was pulling his chain. He was here on the job, and it had to be related to the North Korean mine.
Not necessary. Just letting you know in case her being here compromises you in some way.
Not at all, he said. But I appreciate your concern.
He glanced at the waitress as she passed.
I'll take a check.
The two men walked out into the wind-blown parking lot. Ryan said, good seeing you, Adam. Take care of yourself.
You do the same, Ryan. Thanks again.
They parted with a handshake, each man climbing back into his car and taking off for Vegas. Ryan had no idea what Yao was up to, but he was damn curious. Yao also didn't have a clue what Ryan was doing here, but in contrast to Ryan, he didn't really want to know. He would alert Mary Pat to what Ryan had told him, but for all he knew, she was already aware. Yao was less concerned about what was going on in California and more concerned about where he was heading next. He would fly out the next morning, and he couldn't go into this with any doubt in his mind he could pull it off.
Chapter 43 Veronica Martell returned to her 19th floor hotel room at the Palazzo on the Las Vegas Strip, threw her purse on her bed, and sat down at her open laptop. She clicked open a program, then she slipped a connector into the base of her mobile phone and the other end into the laptop. She hit a key, and instantly the contents of the phone, or at least the contents of the phone that were the application files stolen from NewCorp servers, began to upload to a cloud file-sharing service. There they would be picked up by Edward Riley and forwarded on to whoever at New World Metals LLC was going to give them to the North Koreans. She didn't know how that end of the chain worked, and she didn't care. All she knew was her job, and the fact she had done her job perfectly today. It had not been an easy task. It had been an ordeal to spend the last 2 weeks working in an industry she knew little about, while simultaneously feigning rapt fascination with Ralph Baggett, the slovenly IT director at Valley Floor. This certainly didn't make the top 10 worst assignments she had faced in her career, but she would have much rather spent her time doing most anything other than this. Nevertheless, she'd done it. She'd not gleaned the password to the server from Baggett as she had planned, but she had been able to download the files from his terminal after he'd put in the password himself and left the machine unattended, and that was just as good. The fact she'd pulled it off with a minimal amount of heavy petting and no actual sex with Baggett was a bonus for her, but she had been prepared to go to whatever lengths were necessary to achieve her goal. And now, with her operation complete, Veronica had only to return to Valley Floor Mine tomorrow for her last day of her 2 week stint, and then endure an evening bon voyage party with several people she'd been working with in Hydra Metallurgy Quality Control, as well as Baggett, who'd managed to get himself invited along. Veronica thought it idiotic that these people she'd worked with for only 2 weeks were throwing a going-away party for her. In France, she could have worked in an office 10 years and not even known the first names of her colleagues. But this was America, and it was the American way to be silly like this. If she had her choice, she'd fly home tonight and never see any of them again. No. Actually, this was not true. There was someone she wouldn't mind seeing again. Veronica found it ironic that on the day she had executed her mission, she found the actual execution of the mission to be the second most interesting thing that had happened to her. On that note, Veronica lifted her phone to make a call. Now that she had downloaded the NewCorp files, it was time for her to call Riley and report a contact.
Among the first things an intelligence officer learns as part of his or her training in both OPSEC and PERSEC is to report all contacts with strangers up the chain of command. An idle conversation about the weather with an unfamiliar person at the taxi queue might be relevant to someone with knowledge of the larger scheme of the operation, no matter how random it feels to the operator on the ground. Meeting the son of the U.S. president while in the act of obtaining access to the plant application server could not possibly have any sort of relevance to her New World Metals operation. But letting her boss know was SOP. Operational security on any mission dictated that an agent in the field notify his or her control officer at the first sight of anything out of the ordinary. And if anything ever qualified as out of the ordinary, it would be exactly this situation. But as she prepared to dial Riley's New York mobile number, Veronica stopped herself. Wait. Could this be useful? She put the phone down and thought for a moment, and when she was finished thinking, she chastised herself for taking all afternoon to come to the obvious conclusion. She'd been in the corporate intel world so long she'd forgotten how to see past her small, narrow, and mundane marching orders and take a look at the larger picture, the larger opportunity in front of her. No, now was not the time to dutifully consider Sharp's global intelligence partners' best practices. Now was the time to look out for herself. The U.S. president's son. Yes, Veronica thought. I can use this. Veronica had lived like a rudderless ship for the past few years, working in corporate intel, but the one thing that guided her was the hope. She wondered if it was fantasy, that someday she would get back to French intelligence. She'd left on bad terms 3 years earlier, and she'd wanted back in almost from the start. Her old colleagues had told her to forget about it. She wasn't ever getting back in the good graces of the executives at DGSE. Then, today happened. Today she bumped Jack Ryan Jr. There was no question that, if exploited carefully and slowly, he could prove to be an incredible access point for French intelligence. They could learn details about the American president that they wouldn't otherwise be able to obtain. And they could only do it through Veronica. They'd have to take her back. Of course, Martel would need to start a relationship with the handsome and eligible young bachelor, but that problem looked like it was sorting itself out nicely. Jack had proven to be just like so many other men in this world. He would close the distance between the two of them without her having to lift a finger. Yes, she would begin a relationship with Ryan. She would contact DGSE, and she would tell them she was coming home with a prize. French intelligence would welcome her back with open arms. She wasn't going to breathe a word of this to Riley, of course. Instead, she would mention her going-away party to Ryan the next day when he came to her department, and she would spend the evening ignoring Baggett and cultivating Ryan as an asset. She smiled to herself, satisfied to be finishing one job and overlapping into a job that had the potential to reap incredible reward. Chapter 44. Adam flew from Las Vegas to Los Angeles, and from there to Shanghai on an Airbus A330 flown by China Eastern. He sat in the back of coach and spent his time listening to Korean language audio files on his mobile phone. He erased the files 2 hours before touchdown in China, so there would be no record of his study of the language anywhere on his person. Shortly after landing, Adam entered the immigrations area of Shanghai Pudong International Airport, waited his turn, and then stepped up to the immigration control officer sitting behind a desk. The man took Adam's U.S. passport. It claimed his name was Shan Xin, and then looked through it. He stopped on the Chinese visa, affixed to one of the pages. In Mandarin, he asked, "You are Chinese?"
"Yes.
I left China 18 years ago to go to school in U.S. "You haven't been back here?"
"No, sir."
"Married an American?" The immigration officer didn't know this, but he assumed as much.
"That is correct. I am home to visit family."
"Where is your Chinese passport?"
"I lost it long ago.
The embassy said I could travel on my U.S. passport and obtain a new Chinese passport while I am here if I provide my birth records. All that information is here with my mother." The officer eyed Yao carefully, then began thumbing through his passport slowly. He checked the few stamps that were there, and then he put the passport under a tabletop magnifier and examined the binding. If Adam hadn't known what was going on, he would have been nervous. But he was aware they always did this at Chinese immigration control. The man was looking for evidence a page or pages had been removed with a razor in an attempt to get rid of entrance stamps. Foreigners traveling to China are not admitted if they have any Nepal entrance stamps. The control officer found nothing amiss, and 4 minutes after stepping up to the desk, Adam Yao took his passport back, hefted his luggage off the floor, and began walking toward the arrivals area of the airport. He was now, according to his legend, Shan Xin, a Chinese national. 3 hours after arriving in Shanghai, Adam Yao entered a plain building in Shanghai's Kunshan suburb. Inside, he took an elevator to the second floor and then knocked on an unmarked metal door. He saw the peephole darken for a moment, and then an intercom next to the door crackled. In Mandarin, he heard, "Name?"
"Shan Xin.
I have an appointment with Mr. Hu." The door clicked open. 2 men looked at his passport, and then they frisked him carefully, removing his wallet, his mobile phone, and even a watch. One of them said, "Listening devices. Everyone must be searched." Adam had brought nothing incriminating into China, so he remained relaxed, and soon they led him into an office where a dour-looking older man sat behind a desk. This was Hu. Adam knew because he had video-conferenced with the man from Virginia via Skype in order to get the job. At the time, Hu had explained the job would be at one of the gangster miner operations in Mongolia, and he'd stressed that he needed Adam, or Shan Xin, as he knew him, to come to Shanghai as soon as possible for further vetting and processing. As in the Skype teleconference, in person Hu was all business. He questioned Adam on his background and on his knowledge of the computer system used to operate the hydraulic cone crushers. Adam could tell from the outset this wasn't some sort of security check to confirm Yao's identity. Instead, Hu was just making sure that Shan Xin possessed the qualifications for the job. Adam had passed all this in their Skype interview 2 weeks earlier, but it was clear to Yao that Hu was a careful man. Perhaps not careful enough to recognize a CIA plant, but more than careful enough not to hire an unqualified employee. Finally, the older Chinese man was satisfied, and he pulled out some paperwork. "As we are not state-owned, we have a more informal approach." Adam thought Hu's understatement was funny. Not only was the company not state-owned, it was wholly illegal. He kept his face blank. "You will work on an 8-week contract, and you can be let go at any time."
"Yes."
"After 8 weeks, you can get 1 week off, or you can keep working if you want." Adam wanted to look eager.
"I came here to work, not for vacation."
Hu looked him over and then nodded. He said, "You will tell no one that you have been in America, ever. Certainly you will keep quiet that you have an American passport. I will keep it here. It is procedure." Yao knew why, but he pretended like he didn't. The people at the mine don't like Americans? Hu lit a cigarette and leaned back. He spoke matter-of-factly. This processing plant you are going to is not in Mongolia, like we said. I wasn't allowed to mention it before you came here, and when I tell you where you will be working, you will understand why. Yao was a good actor, and reveled in the portrayal of a man genuinely confused. I don't understand. Where will I be working? Later today, you and 43 other men and women will travel in a bus to the airport, and you will board a plane to Pyongyang. The mine is in the north of the DPRK, not very far from the border with China. Yao's eyes went wide. Before he spoke, Hu said, It is all arranged at the highest levels of their state-owned mining corporation. Once you are in the air to Pyongyang, a North Korean government official will give you the documentation you need to get into the country. What about the Chinese government? To the government here, you never left China. Adam raised no complaints, and he signed all the papers using the name Shan Xin. Hu finished the meeting with a warning. We already have sent over 150 workers to the mining operation in North Korea. They are paid well, so they do not complain, but they report difficult conditions. I understand. Remember, you will be working in a facility under guard at all times. Don't do anything to raise any suspicion with the authorities in North Korea. Do your work. Don't ask questions. Don't look around. Don't complain. And don't give them any reason to mistrust you. You do this, and you will make a lot of money. If you don't do this, there is nothing anyone here can do for you. Adam nodded calmly, as if blowing off the warning. But the truth was different. He felt an unmistakable feeling of dread about where he was going. The flight from Shanghai to Pyongyang was in an Airbus A319, flown by Learjet, a Chinese charter company based in Beijing. On board the aircraft, Adam met a few of the others heading to Chongzhou. Most, if not all, seemed bewildered by the fact they were heading into North Korea. It was clear all these men and women were educated professionals. They didn't look like miners any more than Adam did. He knew that in order to staff the processing facility, Hu and his gangster mining company needed to recruit qualified systems engineers, computer technicians, and other high-tech industry professionals, and few, if any, of these people would have experience with the criminal underworld. Adam hoped to use this to his advantage. He'd fit in better where he was going if he behaved just like the rest of them. A little wide-eyed about the whole thing, but dedicated to his one specific role. They landed at 7 in the evening and deplaned within minutes. Adam had the feeling this was the only aircraft flying into the airport at the moment, because the terminal was empty except for two long rows of young soldiers in green parade dress uniforms who virtually lined the walkway from the gate to the immigration control area. Adam walked between the soldiers, following in the middle of the pack of tired Chinese, doing his best to keep his head down. He stole a couple of furtive glances, though, and he saw the soldiers were both male and female. They seemed to have programmed scowls on their faces, and they held their locally made Kalashnikov-style rifles across their chests at the ready. Adam could plainly see the weapons' fire selectors were switched off the standard safe setting and set to fire semi-automatically at the press of the trigger. Christ, the American thought. His trip through immigration control was like none he'd ever experienced in his life. The Chinese technicians were each sent to their own table in a large open area in the middle of the terminal. Here, five armed and scowling immigration officers stood at the ready. Adam was led to his table, and in the poor Mandarin spoken by a female soldier standing behind him, he was told to put his bag up on the table and unzip it. He did so, and two officers began taking everything out and going through it. He then was ordered to hand over his wallet, his employment contract, and his passport to a white-haired man. While this man looked through every page of his documents, a fourth official began frisking Adam from head to toe. He was ordered to strip down to his underwear. This he did in the view of not only the female North Korean officers, but also the female Chinese technicians, who were stripping down themselves. Every shred of their clothing was inspected, and then each person was wanded with a handheld metal detector. All in all, Adam spent more than 20 minutes in his underwear. He was a fit and confident young man, but standing in front of two young females with guns in their hands and fuck-you stares on their faces was as uncomfortable an experience as he'd ever felt. Right in the middle of the lengthy process, Yao heard a disturbance at another table. A man raised his voice, speaking in Korean.
"What is this? What did I find here? What do you have to say for yourself?"
Adam turned to the action. A 30-ish female Chinese woman Adam had met on the flight over stood in her bra and panties, looking at what an immigration officer held out in his hand. She didn't understand his words, so she waited for a translation. A North Korean minder who spoke Chinese came over and looked at the alleged contraband, then turned to the woman.
"This is a Korean dictionary. Why do you have this?"
In Chinese, the woman replied with genuine confusion.
"Why? Are you kidding? I don't speak Korean. I bought it in the airport. I thought it would be helpful to know a few words."
"Helpful to your espionage."
"What? Of course not."
The woman was led away by the arm, still in her underwear and openly weeping. Her luggage remained open and unattended on the table, with her clothes scattered across the table and the floor. Adam did not say a word. He hoped like hell she'd be expelled for this. He couldn't imagine a better outcome for the lady. In fact, he didn't know if he should feel sorry for her or envy her. North Korea sucked already. He chastised himself for this thought. Silently, he said, "What the hell did you expect, Adam?" After the lengthy immigration process and the loss of one of their number, Adam and the 42 remaining Chinese technicians were put on a bus and taken through the dark and nearly empty streets of Pyongyang to the Yonggakdo International Hotel. Adam knew all about this place. The rumors were there was only one floor in operation, the 26th. The rest of the place was closed and shuttered because, despite the impression the North Koreans wanted to make with the massive business-class hotel, there were so few foreign businessmen in the city, they needed only a couple dozen rooms at any one time. Of course, with the arrival of the technicians, Adam assumed he'd be going to some previously mothballed floor. In the lobby, they were told to line up, and one of the impeccably dressed minders said, "I will pass out your keys. 4 people to a room. Everyone will be staying on the 26th floor." Wow, Adam thought. He and his cohorts were probably the only people in the hotel, and virtually the only foreign travelers in the huge city. A small reception for the Chinese technicians began at 9 p.m. in a banquet room in the basement. To get there, Adam had to line up with the others on the 26th floor and wait for a group of minders to come up and then ferry everyone down in groups in the elevator. Adam knew he should have been made uneasy by the tight control. It was probably like being in a maximum security prison, after all. But to Adam, it felt more like his memories of grammar school. Grown-ups making the children line up and wait, and constantly checking their every move. The banquet room was almost comically ornate, and 5 times too large for the quantity of Chinese technicians. 12 waitresses worked the room, none of whom spoke a word of Chinese. Adam chatted with his new colleagues, but most of them were too nervous to enjoy themselves, so the conversation was stilted. One of the waitresses turned a radio on and held a PA microphone up to the little speaker, broadcasting thin and scratchy revolutionary music throughout the banquet hall. Adam would have enjoyed the spectacle of the scene, and he could have stayed for hours, but he stopped drinking after 2 beers. He figured he would need 50 to calm his nerves, considering his predicament, and he was very aware of the fact good intelligence officers did not become better intelligence officers the drunker they got. So he just held his mostly empty bottle, grinned stupidly, and bobbed his head with the music. He tipped well, but not enough to draw attention to himself, and then he went to the door, where a minder met him to escort him back to his room. On his way back up to the 26th floor, he remembered something else about this hotel. To confirm the rumor, he leaned around his minder at the front of the car and looked at the floor numbers. Yes, just like he'd been told, Adam saw that the 5th floor did not exist. He assumed that was where the watchers and listeners associated with North Korean counterintelligence all worked. He knew that here in the Yonggakdo International Hotel, every last thing he did and said would be recorded and videoed. Yao wasn't terribly concerned by this. He'd lived in China, after all, so he was accustomed to draconian intelligence measures. But when it came to paranoid security protocols, the DPRK was starting to make the Chinese look like rank amateurs. Chapter 45. Things were going according to plan for Veronica Martell. Her goal of getting close to Jack Ryan Jr. was moving along even quicker and more easily than she'd anticipated, and she caught herself already thinking about her life back in Paris once she returned to French intelligence, with him as a recruited asset. He had come into her department just after 9 this morning and spent most of an hour making notes about the equipment and the processes. Then he returned to her temporary office and talked to her a little more about solvent extraction. He'd thanked her for her time and exchanged business cards. And then, after allowing herself a reasonable time so as not to show a level of interest that had the tendency to drive confident men away, she'd brought up the evening soiree that her colleagues were putting on and, in as offhand a way as possible, she suggested Ryan might drop by. Ryan took the bait easily and said he would love to attend. Luckily for Veronica, the woman in QC in charge of arranging the after-work event had yet to settle on a meeting place, so Veronica had gotten Ryan's mobile number, with plans to text him when all was decided upon. He'd gone back to his office for a few hours, but at the end of the day she told him everyone was getting together at 8 o'clock in the trendy V bar in the Venetian Hotel. Veronica had not doubted for a minute that he would show up. He entered the bar at 8:15, looking admittedly handsome in a lightweight tan sport coat and jeans, and although he'd sat farther away than the ever-present and always annoying Ralph Baggett, Ryan had soon slipped down a few seats to position himself directly across from her. Baggett, as he had been for the past 2 weeks, was doing his best to monopolize Martell's time, but the French spy handled him deftly. She included Ryan in her conversations and did it in a way that she was certain felt natural to both Baggett and Ryan. Things were going according to plan for Jack Ryan Jr. His goal of getting close to Elise Legrand was progressing even quicker and more easily than he'd anticipated. He'd entered her department this morning, spent just the right amount of time with her to show casual interest, and garnered himself an invitation to her going-away party that evening. As soon as he learned he'd see her again, he relaxed, because he knew his objective would be easier to fulfill in a crowd than alone in her office. It was crucial that he get his hands on her phone, since Gavin Beery had decided it to be the most likely device she would employ to remove anything from the new corp servers. Jack had been trained in pickpocketing and other sleight-of-hand techniques, so he liked his chances if he could get close enough to the woman in a social environment where others were around. He and the rest of the team had spent the early evening working out a plan to take a peek at her digital data. Ryan had the phone Gavin had sent him from Alexandria, and to extract the data from her phone and put it on Gavin's, he needed to have her device in his possession for only 2 to 3 minutes. He was certain he could do this at some point during the party, but the guys also bandied around other possibilities. Could he actually social engineer more information out of her? Details on where she was going next, information about her client's identity, the benefactor paying millions of dollars to the North Koreans? The campus operatives knew there was likely as much or more crucial data in the head of Elise Legrand as there was on her phone, and the question remained how they could get that data out. Clark was against Ryan pursuing some sort of physical relationship with the woman. Even when Jack suggested he ask her for an innocuous drink after the party so he could dig a little deeper into her psyche to see if there was an opening there, Clark was less than enthusiastic. One question for you, Ryan. Shoot. What happened to the last son of a bitch we watched having a drink with that woman? Have you forgotten about Vietnam? Dom had been sitting quietly, listening to the conversation, but he said, "Ouch." Ryan shook his head. I've got you guys watching my back. We were watching Hazelton's back, too, Clark growled. Damn lot of good that did him. This sank in for a moment. Ultimately, however, a compromise was made in the form of another device Beery had FedExed over from Alexandria. It was a tiny, clear earpiece with a half-inch-long dangling battery pack. It looked just like a small hearing aid, but it could attach via Bluetooth like a regular earpiece headset and transmit as well as receive. Unlike the other units the men wore, this one had an external microphone that picked up sounds around the person wearing it. Ryan tested it out, his hair just long enough to cover most of it in his ear, and with it in place, the rest of the team could hear him and the conversations of those around him. And more important to Clark, Ryan would be able to hear transmissions and take direction. Clark gave Ryan the green light to go to the party and do his best to access the French woman's phone, and he gave him the yellow light to proceed carefully after that to garner more intel if feasible. That said, Clark was going to be listening in on the entire evening, and he even went along to the Venetian Hotel and found a bench in the lobby's shopping galleria, where he would be just a few seconds away if Ryan ran into trouble. He made it very clear to Ryan he would not hesitate to give the younger man the hook and put the kibosh on the operation if he didn't think things were working out. The party, like most after-work company get-togethers, started with work-related chatter, but by the time the second round of drinks had been polished off, the participants loosened up, except for Elise Legrand. Ryan noted her great skill in deflecting personal conversation and the almost hawk-like way she watched the other people at the table, usually silently. She eyed Ryan most of all, and this was not lost on him. He'd caught her eye a number of times, which wasn't difficult as they were seated across from each other, but she held his gaze in a way that he found a little off-putting, her incredible beauty notwithstanding. The table of 12 began thinning out after an hour, as most of the attendees had kids at home, early starts the next morning, or both. A core group of hard chargers stayed around for a third drink, but by the time the fourth round was dropped by the cocktail waitress, only Ryan, Baggett, and the woman everyone knew as Elise from Quebec City remained. Ryan had spent the last 45 minutes waiting for his opportunity to act. He was ready to move around to Elise's side of the table to make a play for her phone, and he had a half-dozen ready-made excuses to make it happen, too. But first he needed to know the location of the device. Was it in a pocket, in her purse, in her hand? Even with his new sleight-of-hand skills, He couldn't very well sit down next to her and frisk her from head to toe, and because he'd seen no hint of the device in the 90 minutes since he'd arrived, he'd bided his time, waiting for her to reveal it. The fact he hadn't seen it so far told him it was probably in her purse, so when she finally picked up her small silver clutch off the table and reached inside, he began moving into action. Just as he stood to head around the table to show Ralph and Elise something on his phone, he eyed her right hand. She held a phone in it and was checking it for text messages. But instantly Ryan realized the phone in her hand wasn't the one he had seen her with all week at Valley Floor. Damn it. She'd switched phones. He knew he needed to pull data off the device she'd had at the facility, because that would be the most likely to contain the intel he was looking for. Where was that phone? In her room? Jack had no idea where she was staying. She hadn't offered the information, and he'd not seen a natural opportunity to get it out of her. He felt certain she was somewhere on the Vegas Strip. All the other visitors to the Newcorp Valley Floor facility he'd run into had been, but without that knowledge he couldn't very well send another campus operative off on a sneaking peek. Jack excused himself to go to the restroom. The team could hear his every word, so he began speaking as soon as he was out of earshot from the table. Listen up, new sit rep. She's got a different phone on her. Damn, Chavez said. What the hell does that mean? Ryan said, I think it means Gavin was right. The other phone was for the operation. She got what she needed, so she's left that phone in her room. Or hell, I don't know, it could be in her purse. Dom said, you've got to check her purse. Ryan fired back, and you've got to check her room. Where's she staying? Unknown. Cuz, this is Vegas. There are 125,000 hotel rooms in this town. You want I should start kicking in doors? Ryan grumbled a few cuss words of frustration, then said, okay, I'll find out for you while I'm digging through her purse. You just sit there and take it easy in the meantime. Clark's admonishing low grumble came over the net. Gentlemen, Ding chimed in now. Ryan, it's okay. Check her purse, and if it's not there, tip us off by asking her about where she's staying. I'm online now, and Gavin's IT hacks have given me visibility into all the hotel records in town. You find out the name of the hotel, and I'll get her room number. We'll send Dominic to break in while you watch the girl. Ryan agreed, although Ding made it sound easier than he imagined it would prove to be. I've got to get back. Baggett might try to kidnap her. Ding replied, that French spook would rip his balls off. Ryan returned to find Baggett gone, and Elise Legrand alone at the large table, checking her phone and clutching her purse in her lap. Jack sat back down. What happened to Ralph?
He had to leave. He asked me to wish you a good evening.
Ryan did his best to hide his pleasure, but Clark's voice entered his right ear and cooled his excitement. This is too easy. Keep your eyes open, kid. Something's fishy. Clark was insinuating the Sharp's intelligence officer might herself be operating against Ryan, but Ryan scoffed at this. He thought she was just interested in him and acting out of attraction. That she'd managed to clear Ralph Baggett's playing piece off the board was good news for Ryan and his mission, not evidence that the woman had any objective beyond spending some time alone with him. He watched her put her phone back in her purse, and while she did so, he got a fair look inside. There was no other phone. Ryan now knew he needed to find out the name of her hotel. He didn't have time to go slowly with this, so he started immediately. What do you think of the Venetian? He was hoping she would say something about the rooms, an indication this was her hotel. But she just looked around her. It's nothing like Venice. Not really, no. Still, it's pretty nice. Jack went for broke. Where are you staying? She blinked once, perhaps a little surprised at the question. But she answered,
Next door, at the palazzo.
Really? Jack said. That's funny.
So am I.
The Frenchwoman's eyes narrowed. Ryan could see she didn't believe him, and instantly he worried he'd screwed up. He wanted an excuse to stay with her a little longer so he could watch her while Dom worked, and if he claimed he was at the same hotel, then they could possibly walk back together. Clark had warned Ryan she would have a good BS detector, but he'd pressed his luck anyway. In his earpiece, he heard Ding's voice, rushed.
I'm getting you a room there now.
What room? Legrand asked, clearly challenging his story. Ryan raised his eyebrows.
I'm sorry? What is your room number at the palazzo?
Damn. He couldn't just pull a room number out of the air. She might continue challenging him, check for herself, and he'd be caught in a lie. Ding heard the question.
Gonna take a couple of minutes, Ryan. Stall her.
Jack smiled. That's a bit forward, isn't it?
I am not saying it to be forward. I am saying it because I do not believe you are telling the truth. I don't really know what you are doing. But I think you just lied to me for some reason.
Jack just said, You have trust issues. He felt like a heel, but he was committed to this now, and he couldn't back away.
I have trust issues, because I have been around people who do not tell the truth. Like now, for instance.
Ryan could tell she was fully on guard. She prodded him for a minute, asked him where he was really staying, but he stuck with his story. Finally, Elise said,
Last chance, to be honest, Jack. Where are you staying?
Jack smiled. Let's go. I'll show you my room. He held his breath.
You're bluffing, she said, a coquettish smile on her face.
She truly didn't believe him, and she looked like she would relish putting him in his place. Jack felt sure she thought this was all just a ploy to get her dress off. He was bluffing. He didn't have a room key. But Ryan couldn't imagine the poised and refined woman in front of him taking him up on the offer, even if she didn't believe him. As bluffs went, he felt pretty good about this one. He said, I think you are the one who's bluffing. You won't go. She did not reply to this. Instead, she said,
I googled you today.
Really? Did you enjoy the pictures of a 14-year-old me with goofy hair and braces? Without smiling, she said,
Very much so.
Of course, I established you do work for Hendley Associates. You didn't believe that either? She didn't answer. Instead, she said,
There is really nothing bad about you online, but I am surprised how little news there is about you since you got out of college. It's as if you went into the shadows after that.
Now, Ryan was beginning to get nervous. She was a spook, and spooks got suspicious easily. But he was surprised at the level on which she was challenging him. He wondered if she knew more about him than she was letting on, and if that had her concerned, her intelligence operation had been compromised. Jack just replied, There's not much news about me online for one simple reason. I am a bore. It works to my advantage. People get bored by bores.
You are asking a woman you do not know to come to a hotel room you do not have. That is strange, but I would not say it is boring.
Ryan said, You still don't believe me.
Not for an instant.
You need an excuse to follow me back to my hotel, so you claim it to be your hotel. You thought I wouldn't question this. Perhaps you thought we'd sit and have another drink together in the bar there before I took you up to my bed.
Presumptuous.
experienced. Finally, ding came over Jack's earpiece. Room 3908, Junior Suite. Clark's on his way to get your key at the front desk, and if you can stall her for 20 minutes, Dom will have your shit moved from over here at the Mandarin into your room. Jack thought it was a bit hasty of Chavez to assume he was going to take this woman up to his hotel room. Hell, he didn't even have the key, and he didn't know how they could get it to him without her seeing the exchange. Jack stood up and said, Room 3908. Not denying her premise, but challenging her nonetheless. For the first time, the woman smiled. Okay, Jack Ryan Jr., let's go to the palazzo and see this room of yours. Jack hesitated. Oops. Ding shouted into his ear. Not yet. Shit! We are not ready! Jack asked a passing waitress for the check, and he hoped like hell she was extremely bad at her job, and took a long time producing it. Chapter 46. The very second his cousin announced he was staying at the Palazzo Hotel, Dom Caruso leapt to his feet in the suite at the Mandarin Oriental, ran into Ryan's room, and began scooping up loose clothes, shoes, even his computer and peripherals, and he threw them haphazardly into an open rolling duffel on the floor. He then rifled through his cousin's closet, took pressed shirts and a suit, wadded them into a ball and crammed them inside the duffel, threw in a dop kit full of toiletries, zipped it up, and ran with it for the door. He slung a backpack go-bag of his own over his shoulder and left the suite. The valet downstairs had the keys to the Mercedes E-Class the team was using in town. The Mandarin Oriental was about a mile and a half south of the Palazzo on the Strip, a significant distance in traffic, so Dom didn't plan on waiting for the valet. As he rushed to the elevator, he put the conference call with the rest of the team on hold on his phone, then dialed the saved mobile number to the head valet on duty tonight. Clark had befriended the man and a few of his co-workers just after they had checked in. The man answered, and Dom spoke rapidly. Andy, this is Bobby, Mr. Phillips' nephew. The team all had cover identities, and Clark had issued a standing order forbidding any of the team to say Clark was their dad. Therefore, he was always Uncle Joe, Uncle Pete, or Uncle Something on their ops.
Hey, bro, what's up?
I'll be there in 3 minutes. If my black E-Class is parked at your stand with the trunk open and the keys in it, I got $50 coming your way.
You got it, bro,
Andy said, and he hung up. Clark was already in the Venetian, so he only had to head next door, which he did in a jog. It took him 5 minutes, and this got him there just 5 or 6 minutes ahead of Ryan and the Frenchwoman. He went to the reception desk, skipped ahead of a couple of Japanese businessmen with several bows and professions of apologies, and picked up the 2 key cards to the junior suite on the 39th floor. Ryan and Elise arrived at the front of the palazzo at the same time a black Mercedes E-Class pulled up to the valet stand. Caruso climbed out just feet away from them, took his luggage out of the trunk, and followed them into the entrance. Just inside the palatial lobby, Dom rolled by them and headed straight for the elevators, like a businessman in some rush to get to his room. In the main lobby, Ryan took Elise by the arm and stopped her. He nodded to a swanky lobby bar. The bartender here makes an incredible margarita. The Frenchwoman just shook her head with a smile. You've probably never set foot here in your life. Jack chuckled, still doing his best to give off the impression he was more fascinated by her mistrust than anything else. No drink first. She shook her head again.
No, thank you. Are we going upstairs, or are you ready to give up on this charade?
Let's go up. I can't wait to see the look on your face.
She shrugged. After you.
Just 25 yards ahead of Ryan and the Frenchwoman, Dom raced to a huge bank of 8 elevators around a corner. 8 of the 16 elevators reached floors 37 through 50. Clark had just entered a car 20 seconds earlier, but he'd left a key in a planter for Dom and told him where he'd dumped it. Dom snatched it from the planter, took the first elevator that arrived, and stepped inside. He noticed the car bypassed floors 7 through 36. He pushed the button for the 39th floor, and the car shot straight up, not stopping at all along the way. John Clark took his elevator up to the second floor, and on the way up he took a small piece of tape, affixed it to Ryan's card, and attached it to the buttons to the right of the door. As he did so, he said, "Listen up, Ryan. When you get to the bank of elevators, the last one will come down to you. Take it. Your card will be taped to the keys to the left of the door." John pushed the button in the car to send it back down, then stepped out. As soon as Ryan and Elise arrived in front of the elevators, the last one dinged and opened. It went against Jack's sense of manners to enter before the woman, so he positioned himself on Elise's left and entered just a half step behind her. He swiveled his body to cover the buttons and saw that the room key card was lightly taped over the 39th floor button. Jack easily popped it off and pressed his floor with the same movement, all while turning around to face her. His hand went down to his side, and he reached into his pocket with the card in his hand, then pulled it out and held it up. She stared at it in disbelief. The elevator rose to the second floor and the door opened. Jack and Elise stood there quietly looking at an empty tile floor. Jack looked at the gorgeous, tall blonde and smiled. "It's a beautiful hotel."
"Seeing it for the first time?"
"No, just mentioning it." The doors closed and they started heading up again. John Clark bolted out of the third-floor stairwell, sweat dripping from his face and his chest heaving from exertion, and he ran toward the elevator bank. He reached it at a sprint and pushed the call button to go up. As soon as he did so, he heard the bell announcing a car was stopping on the floor. He moved quickly out of the sight line of anyone in the car. The door opened just a few feet away from him, and Clark held his breath so as to stop his heavy breathing. In the moment of silence, both in his earpiece and from the car itself, he heard a female speak with a pronounced French accent.
"Damn, children."
Ryan replied, "Little bastards." The door closed. Clark let out a quick sigh of relief and said,
"I stalled them as much as I can, Dom. They'll be less than 60 seconds behind you."
Caruso replied, his own voice affected by heavy breathing,
"Understood."
2 minutes later, Jack slipped the key card into the lock of his hotel room on the 39th floor. He held the door open, but Elise just stood there dumbfounded.
"I don't believe it,"
she said softly, and only after a delay did she enter the room. Jack smiled and followed her in. Then he caught a surprised look on her face. He glanced across the room. Dominic had left a pair of Jack's red boxer shorts in the middle of the floor in the sitting area. Jack groaned inwardly and told himself he'd kick his cousin's ass the next time he saw him. Some other clothing was scattered about. There was a suit laid out neatly on his bed, and his computer was on the coffee table in front of the sofa. It was a little sloppy, but it looked legit.
"Sorry," he said, scooping up his shorts. "I hadn't planned on having company."
Elise did not reply. Instead, she stepped over to the open bathroom door and peered inside. A couple of wet towels lay on the tile floor. The toothbrush was on the vanity next to an open tube of toothpaste, a mouthwash bottle open next to it. The walls and floor of the shower were damp. She turned away and stepped back into the middle of the room. There was an iced bottle of champagne on the coffee table next to the sofa, and Ryan was both surprised and impressed that the hotel had managed to have that ready not more than 20 minutes after the initial reservation had been made. Jack walked over to it and pulled the bottle out of the ice. Elise noticed the wine bucket now, and she cocked her head quickly.
"Why the champagne?" she asked. "Isn't that something that's normally done when you check in?"
Jack scrambled for a second, then said, "It's a little embarrassing."
"More embarrassing than your underwear on the floor?"
Jack laughed. "The owner is a Republican. I don't throw my dad's name around. I'm not even using my own name on the reservation. But sometimes people recognize me. I guess he found out I'm here and he's given me the royal treatment. Champagne every night." Jack added, "I didn't ask for it."
"I see," she replied.
Jack popped the bottle and poured 2 glasses. Then he started to lead Elise toward the couch, but a voice in his ear caused him to change his plans. It was Dominic, and his whisper was barely audible.
"Take her out on the balcony. Now."
Christ, Ryan thought.
Dom was somewhere in this room.
Jack said, "Oh, I forgot. You have to see this view." Jack led her to the balcony, the entire time hoping like hell he actually did have a nice view. Dom Caruso slipped out of the closet next to the bed, shut the door behind him, and dropped down onto the floor. He belly-crawled across the carpet, keeping an eye on the balcony and the backs of his cousin and, much more important, his date, the knockout French spy. When he was certain her focus was firmly on the neon lights of the strip from the 39th floor, Dom rose to his feet and left the room quickly and silently. As soon as he was in the hall, he said, "I'm clear. Ding vector me to her hotel room." Ding said, "There is no reservation under her name at the hotel. Either she's using an alias, or a second alias, or she's using her real name, or she's not staying there." Dom stopped walking in the hallway.
"Well, damn.
Okay, Jack, get back to work. Get it out of her." On the balcony, Elise turned away from the view and looked to Ryan. Her face had softened. She didn't seem as cynical or mistrusting. She said,
"I'm sorry, I didn't believe you."
She took a sip of champagne. Jack took a sip from his glass. "No big deal. So now it's time for you to come clean. Where are you staying?"
"I told you, I'm staying here."
Ryan took his time reading her face. Finally, he said, "I believe you." He heard Clark's voice in his ear now. "Ryan is telling us she is staying there. Domingo, look for reservations under female names that came on the 25th of last month. That's the day before she started work at Valley Floor. There can't be more than a couple of women who have been here for 2 weeks." There was a pause for a moment. Elise and Jack stood out on the balcony and looked over the lights of Las Vegas. Chavez called over the net now.
"Got it. Only 3 females who came on the 25th are still there. One of them is under the name Sophie Brochard from Ontario, Canada, room 3112. That's gotta be our girl."
Dom said, "I'm en route." On the balcony of his suite, Jack turned away from the view of the strip to find Elise going inside to retrieve the champagne bottle. She came back outside, refilled her own glass, then took his glass and did the same. After she put the bottle down on the table on the balcony, she moved back to the railing, extremely close to Ryan. Things were moving curiously fast, and now, far from worrying he'd have to find an excuse to keep the beautiful woman away from her hotel room while his cousin searched for the missing mobile phone, Ryan was less concerned about her wanting to leave and more concerned about her wanting to stay. And then, as if on cue, she leaned forward and kissed him on the lips. Jack was not caught totally off guard. He'd noted her attraction, but there was a difficult moment when she put her hand on the back of his head and pulled him close. The earpiece's battery supply hung behind his ear. It was out of sight, but it was not designed to go undetected if someone was mussing up the hair of the person wearing it. Jack pulled away, a show of hesitation. Clark spoke into his ear, his own voice soft. "Jack, we are not receiving any transmissions from you. Everything okay in there?" Elise said, "Oh, I see. You are married." Jack smiled. "If I were, I think you would have read about it on Google."
"You're gay?"
"I guarantee that would have made the internet."
"Then I have to go to the bathroom."
"Oh," she smiled.
"No problem. I'll wait."
Elise went back into the suite and sat down on the edge of the bed. Ryan stepped into the bathroom, shut the door, and stood there.
"Come on, Jack. What's the fucking plan here?"
Ding spoke through his earpiece.
"Jack, Dom's going to need 15 mics minimum."
"Yeah," he whispered.
"Not a problem."
Oh, boy. Dom did not have a key to get into room 3112, but he didn't let that slow him down. As he stepped up to the door, he pulled out a device built by Gavin Beery and his whiz kids at the campus. It was a microcontroller just larger than a deck of cards, with a small cable that fed from it to a barrel connector. Dom took the connector and knelt down so he could see the bottom of the keycard door locking mechanism. Here, hidden from view of hotel guests, was a tiny round port. He pushed his connector into the port and flipped a switch on his device. Certain brands of keycard locks have these ports for the purpose of recharging the battery on the locking mechanism and uploading the hotel site code, a 32-bit key that provides general access to all locks in the hotel. This is the master key that housekeeping and other hotel workers use so that they don't need an individual and ever-changing card to get into each room. When Gavin powered up his microcontroller by flipping the switch, the lock sent the 32-bit key from the lock down to the device, and then the device read and decoded it and sent it back up to the lock. The green light illuminated next to the keycard access slot in under a second, even though there was no key in the slot. Dominic opened the door, unplugged his device, and slipped it back into his backpack. Ryan stood in the marble bathroom of his junior suite, staring at himself in the mirror, trying to figure out what he was going to do about the woman on his bed. He'd been surprised by how quickly Elise was escalating matters. They were both single, attractive people, and she had shown some interest, but it seemed more of a curiosity to her and less of a lustful nature. Jack thought about kissing her. He'd not been able to properly enjoy it because of the earpiece and the chatter from his team, but otherwise it would have been a different story. Still, he was working, and this wasn't real. The thought of screwing some woman for the purpose of stalling her so someone else could ransack her hotel room made him sick to his stomach. Clark thought the French spook was herself running some kind of op on Jack, either to compromise him or to gain information or influence. But Jack didn't see evidence of that himself. Clark was trained to think OPSEC and only OPSEC, while Jack had a lot of recent experience with members of the opposite sex showing interest in him. He flushed the toilet, ran the water in the sink, and tried to tell himself this wasn't a harmless TV reality show. This was life or death. The woman in the next room was an enemy operative who was working on behalf of the damn North Koreans, and he didn't need to give a rat's ass about anything other than his mission. There was no way to disengage without blowing the objective and revealing that he'd played her, and there was no way to keep her in this room without having sex with her. What's going on, Ryan? Clark asked. Ryan popped his earpiece out of his ear and slid it in his pocket, flipped off the water, and left the bathroom. Time to go to work. Elise was on the bed. She still had her clothes on, but her come-hither look told him he wasn't out of the woods. He took a step toward her. And then her mobile phone rang in her purse. There was a momentary look of surprise on her face. Jack wondered if the distinctive chirping ring meant the call was coming from a particular number. She stood up from the bed and picked her purse up from the coffee table. While doing so, she said, "Sorry, I'd better take this." "Sure," Jack replied. "Hello? It's Riley. Where are you?" Veronica Martell could tell by the Englishman's voice that something was very wrong. "Hi, Rebecca. Nice of you to call, but I am in the U.S. at the moment. It's very late at night over here." "Listen to me," Riley continued, as if she hadn't said a word. "There is a man in your hotel room right now." "What? How do you know?" "Not relevant. The point is, I do know. What I don't know is just what the fuck he is doing, but I have men heading there now to find out. Wherever you are, you get your bloody ass back to your room right now." Ryan sat down on the bed and watched the Frenchwoman turn away as she held the phone to her ear. After a brief conversation, she turned back around, facing Ryan, and her face went from a guise of slight annoyance about the call that Ryan thought might have been feigned to an obvious appearance of anger that was both very real and very dark. Her eyes narrowed, staring directly at Ryan. He didn't know what was happening, but he asked, "Is something wrong?" The woman hung up the phone and snatched up her purse. "Who are you?" "You?" she asked. "What do you mean?" He tried a little chuckle and stood up, began walking over to her. "Don't leave," he told himself. "You Googled me, remember?" When he was halfway across the small suite, she turned and stormed for the door. "What's wrong?" "Wait!" But she was gone, almost at a run, and the door slammed behind her. "Damn it!" Ryan scrambled for his earpiece, digging for it in his pocket, but after a few seconds he gave up with the tiny contraption and dove headfirst across the bed. He grabbed his phone on the nightstand and unlocked it, then opened the conference call. "Dom, get the fuck out of there! She knows!" Chapter 47 Caruso had found the phone. It was in a wheeled rollerboard whose lock he picked in 20 seconds after spending a minute checking it for telltales. Within 3.5 minutes of entering the Frenchwoman's hotel room, he had the device downloading to Gavin's specially designed unit. And then, within seconds of his beginning the download, the frantic call came from Ryan telling him the woman was loose and on her way back to her room. Caruso was less worried about her showing up while he was here. To travel from the 39th floor to the 31st floor, she'd first have to go down to the lobby to reach the other elevator bank, and more worried about how the hell she knew he was here in the first place. She'd gotten a call, Ryan said. Saddam assumed she had Confederates in the hallway who had seen him, Confederates who were somehow patched into hotel security cameras, or Confederates who had bugged her room. Whatever the case, it meant unknown parties were involved in this and aware of him. And this meant trouble. Dom wasn't sure what to do, so he called out to Clark. "John, I'm in the lobby, watching for trouble heading your way. Don't see anyone, but get out of there. Could be someone already up on that floor. This download is going to take a few more minutes." Clark said, "It's too late for covert. They know there was an intrusion. Just snag the phone and bolt." "I was hoping you'd say that." Caruso slipped the two phones joined with a cable into his backpack and started for the door. Her suite was similar to Ryan's. There was a small hallway that ran along the kitchenette and hid the front door from the living room and sleeping area, and Dom ran for it. But once he turned into the little hallway of the suite, he saw the latch of the door slowly lowering. It was too late to escape out the front. Caruso turned and ran back into the suite, leapt over the coffee table and onto the sofa, then over the back of the sofa to the balcony door. He unlocked it and flung it open, then started outside. There was a boom of a handgun discharge in the room behind him, then the crashing of glass right next to his head as the sliding glass door shattered. Dom took the 8-foot-deep balcony in 2 bounds, rolled over the side of the railing, grabbing the metal bar on the outside of the balcony, then scaling down quickly to the bottom of the railing. A second loud report from the room sounded closer than the first, and Dom struggled to hold on as his feet dangled 31 stories over Las Vegas Boulevard. He heard Clark in his ear calling to him, but he concentrated on swinging his body back away from the building to pick up some momentum. He just started his swing forward when he felt his fingertips slip off the metalwork of the balcony above his outstretched arms, and he looked up just in time to see an Asian man in a black hoodie leaning over the side, a suppressed pistol in his hands. Dom swung to the balcony below him, let go fully now, and crashed onto a padded settee and then through a plexiglass bistro table. The crash knocked the wind out of him, and he knew he'd battered his arms and ribs, but he fought his way to his feet and looked back up. The Asian assassin could not see him from the balcony above, but he must have dropped to the floor of the balcony because Dom now saw the pistol appear at the end of an arm that waved back and forth, pointing down to the balcony where Dom stood. With a flash and a loud boom, the man fired. The round crashed through the locked glass door just 3 feet to Dom's left. He dove to the ground on his right. Another round barked. This one hit the glass closer to Dom. Dom leapt back to his feet, grabbed a metal chair and swung it up and out at the gun. He struck it as a fourth round fired, and he knocked the weapon from the man's hand. It arced out away from the building and fell from view. Dom didn't want to wait around to see if this assassin